50 years ago, a music venue opened at the corner of Vine and Calhoun Streets in Clifton near the campus of the University of Cincinnati. Reflections became a destination for music fans around the region and now famous musical acts from around the country like Yes, the Doobie Brothers, and the Allman Brothers Band. I'm Lee Hay, and I drove up from Morehead State University to see the Allman Brothers show, which was packed that night. During this one-hour special, you'll hear from Doug Yeager, one of the co-founders, plus others who helped with promotion and booking, as well as some folks who attended concerts there. You'll also hear from guitarist Sandy Nasson, who opened up for the James Gang, which was the very first concert at Reflections on November 10, 1970. And from Dale Maloney, the club's general manager, who shares some of his memories too, plus lots of music from some of the groups who played at Reflections, a legendary Cincinnati concert venue.
This is Sander, also known as Sandy Nasson, speaking to you from Phoenix, Arizona, where it's currently 101 degrees. Hello, Cincinnati. I just wanted to share a little bit about my experience with Reflections, which is a fond one. But it's interesting, even though it was one of the opening acts I opened for James Gang, and I'm pretty sure Doug Yeager invited me to do so, I didn't see a lot of concerts there because obviously I was playing the same time there were concerts there. But one of the other concerts I did attend was Kotke, and that's what I remember. But I gave directions to the club several times to people on the street. They were just off by a block, you know. That I remember, and I was always impressed by the energy put into the club and coming out of the club. It was awesome. And, you know, the Black Dome was across the street from that. So that was quite a corner. Plus the Golden Triangle at Moss's place was at another corner. So it was a busy, busy part of town.
And you stayed in touch with the James Gang after you played with them.
Yes, we were very friendly. In fact, friendly to the point of where on their third album, which was called Thirds, I think I'm in the fifth or sixth line of thank yous. There's at least 120 names on that, thank yous. But for some reason, I made it on the thank you page. And it was cute. Yeah, we stayed in touch. Joe was keenly interested in how I was making some of my sounds from a guitar and an amplifier, and that was it because I didn't have many foot pedals in one. And we touched base. When they played other places, I showed up and so forth. And wherever I was playing, in Beverly, Massachusetts, and he lived up in Lynn, and he came down to see me at Lenny's on the Turnpike. And I went to visit him when he was living in Boulder, and then again when he was living on the West Coast. That we had a good connection for about the first 10 years after meeting, including to this day, this is so cute, I had mentioned to him, I said, you know, when I cut my strings, the wire cutters, they go bad in about six sets of strings. And he mailed me a wire cutters that I just used yesterday. I've been using it since then. He also, at one point, I had a copper slide that he gave me. But I think I didn't misplace it. I think it was misplaced for me when someone found out that I had received it from Joe Walsh. Joe and I stayed in touch, and Jimmy Fox and I stayed in touch with the James Gang. And Jimmy was a percussionist, and the first album I did was Just Guitar, which was produced by Herbie Mann, and that was on Atlantic Records in New York City. And the second one was a direct-to-disc recording that was sort of a fad at one for a while, and which meant I recorded straight to the master lathe. And then Nasson direct to disc was put out, and a part of it was recorded up in Cleveland, and Jim Fox was the producer of one side of it, and the other side was done in New York, and Tom Sobel produced that. And so I have a nice history with the James Gang, plus a lot of fond memories.
We'll be right back. everybody. Great to be back on the air in Cincinnati. Mark Tipton here. And even though I've been in California 15 years now, memories go back to the late 60s and early 70s when the whole rock scene was happening in Cincinnati. You know, in Clifton, the rock scene kind of evolved over the years. When I was too young, I was still living in Sailor Park before I went to UC. The big place to go is the Black Dome, which was on Vine Street, which happened to be right across from where they built Reflections. And then the scene then shifted right across the street to Reflections, and it seemed, it was the epicenter for all of the rock groups. Everybody who was anybody would play that stage, and you'd park up above it and walk down a ramp to the front door, and you'd go in, they'd check you in, and you'd pay your money. And as you walked in, the stage was over to the left, and it seems to me it was like down a couple of levels, and the bar was over to the right. And that stage, you never knew who you were going to see. Sometimes, I remember Chicago once played someplace like the Gardens or some other big venue, and then after the show, the whole band showed up at Reflections. And any of the big label acts, you name it, they played that stage. Of course, no one knew who a lot of these acts were at the time because they were coming up. The Doobie Brothers had a great show, the Doobie Brothers, there on the Reflection stage. And I had a record rep friend who shall remain nameless, but I'm sure some of my friends will know who I'm talking about. He was kind of a character, and he used to get, shall we say, enhanced. And I remember seeing him walking on his hands, on a handstand, walking across the stage at Reflections. But until the ascendancy of Bogart's, the place to see the shows in Cincinnati was at Reflections. It was the place. And a lot of the memories are sort of clouded in a blue fog. But what I remember, it was a blast. And I'm so thankful I got to experience that period of time up on Calhoun Street in Clifton.
I'm Gary Schell, and I spent a good portion of my early life at Reflections. I lived in Mount Adams at the time. I was going to school and rode a bicycle back and forth between Mount Adams and Reflections several nights a week. I think the biggest standout show that I saw there, and there were other bigger names, but the biggest standout show for me was seeing War. That was just incredible. And I forget the fellow's name that played harmonica, Lee something or other, who was just incredible, but the whole band was amazing. The vibe that night was just over the top. The crowd ate them alive. I did see Yes there as well, which was another incredible show, and the lines were out the door and around the block for that one, but I got there early enough that I was able to get in. I think I saw Little Feet there once. I can't recall for sure. I know I saw Little Feet somewhere in that time period. Let's see, who else do I remember that played there? Oh, The Pretty Things. I remember that one. And Ron Argent. Oh, God, that was a really incredible show, too. And the biggest thing I remember is the atmosphere of the place was just everybody knew everybody else. And the way the place was laid out with the several tiers, there was the main dance floor and then two tiers up from that. And then there were these big lounging areas on either side that were just sloped flooring that you could lay down on and still be able to see the stage. And that was sort of a gathering place for a lot of people. I recall there was a restaurant inside as well that served pizza and other goodies, and that was pretty nice. And then there was a pool room off to one side as well, and then a VIP area that had, as I recall, a lot of mirrors around it. That was, when you first came in the front door, it was often to the right, up kind of high in the club.
Do you remember the light show of Yes?
There were several bands that had light shows in there. That was something else. They used to do black and white movies, old silent movies, that would play either between bands and sometimes while the bands were even playing. That was really a lot of fun. I remember watching a bunch of Laurel and Hardy stuff through that. But back to your question, yeah, I do remember the light show for Yes was pretty spectacular.
Hi, my name is Jeff McCurdy, and back in December of 1971, my wife and I, recently married in about 3 months, decided to drive up from Morehead State University in a 1965 Ford Custom to see Yes at Reflections. First time we had ever been at Reflections, and because we really wanted to see this band, we came up real early so we could get right in front of the line and get in amongst the early birds. And we were able to do that and sat right on the floor directly in front of the stage. I could reach out and touch the stage. We were right in front of John Anderson, lead vocalist for Yes. This was the Fragile tour for their album, but they were doing songs from the Yes album and Fragile, the newest album. Rick Wakeman, their keyboardist, was in his first tour with the band, having replaced Tony Kaye at that role in the band, and Rick Wakeman just blew our minds with his keyboard work that he did. I can remember that they opened the show with Roundabout, which was just unbelievable to sit right on the floor directly in front of the band. So that's my story of seeing Yes, December 2nd, 1971, at Reflections.
My lover will be there and we'll see you. This is Doug Yeager, and in late 68, early 69, I got together with Bob Ossenbeck, who was a major property owner in Clifton, who owned that piece of land where Reflections was built on Vine between McMillan and Calhoun, and with Daniel Wolf, who had been my partner in Europe for a couple years when we were working at major nightclubs over there, bringing bands from Cincinnati over to Europe, and with Ken Cornell, who had been a former roommate of mine who had recently graduated from architect school at UC. So of the various options that Bob Ossenbeck had on what to put in that spot, we told him about the clubs we were working at in Europe and how they were designed and how they worked and what we thought we could conceive to put in Cincinnati, and he liked the idea. So while Ken Cornell was doing his architectural designs of the place, because it had several levels, where the stage was going to be and how large, and the light booth and the sound booth, et cetera, and Daniel started the process of finding out all the companies where we would buy beer from, et cetera, I helped Bob and his two sons, who had a lot of construction experience, and I had worked my way through college doing construction. And so we were in charge of building the place. Bob and his sons had already laid the foundation. They had dug out the hole, and up until McDonald, he owned McDonald's also. And so there was like a 30-foot back wall, and they laid the initial concrete foundation. Then we needed a work crew we could afford, and what we could afford were the hippies who lived in Clifton and in Mount Adams, and those that were hitchhiking across the country to San Francisco and would somehow stop in Cincinnati. And I believe we paid them $1.50 an hour, and we worked 2 12-hour shifts a day. These people who had nothing and were sleeping on the streets all of a sudden had some money, and they were happy for it. They worked hard. And we had a crew of like 50 workers who were laborers assisting the carpentry work that we were doing and the plumbing and electrical work. And it took more than a year to build the club. We opened in 1970. We only had 3-2 beer at the beginning. We didn't have a full liquor license. And we had people that wanted to come, and they joined. They became members, and they paid money and then would get a card. About 2/3 or 3/4 way through the construction, Bob came to us, and he said, "Guys," he said, "running out of money here. I'm going to have to find someone to come in with more money." And he did, and that was John Dietz, who represented a team of people. So John oversees the finances of the club. Bob became more of a silent partner. But we opened, and John was the one who wanted to make it a club that would be for the younger people at UC with 3-2 beer and having the membership as a way of gaining money. And one of his partners, who then came in, owned a steakhouse franchise. So on the roof of Reflections was a parking lot, but in the back end by McDonald's was the steakhouse. You would drive your car in, you could have a steak and go to the steakhouse and then go downstairs to the club, which 6 nights a week, generally, we would have a local band or regional bands that would often play cover songs that everybody could dance to because we had a big dance floor on the bottom level. And occasionally bands that were popular playing their own music like Whale Feathers and Stone Fox and Haymarket Riot. Local bands, Borrowed Time was a popular band, The Big Orange. Then we decided we wanted to produce concerts. And on November 10th, 1970, we did our first major concert with the national act, and that was James Gang with Sandy Nasson as the opener. And from then on, several times a month, we would have usually on a Monday or Tuesday, which would be off nights, whereas kids would all come out on the weekends, but Monday and Tuesday usually were slow. They weren't off nights, they were just slow nights. So that was perfect to do a concert. And so we had the James Gang, we had the Allman Brothers Band, we had C Train, Chuck Berry, we had Long John Baldry, Velvet Underground, Edgar Winter. So it's a bit of potluck on booking national acts. I would always stay in touch with the agencies in New York and Los Angeles, and they would always let me know if there's a new act coming on the scene and a new album and if a single's coming out. And a few stick in my mind. The first one was Elton John with his first album. And again, his agent was saying, he's going to be great. Everybody loves him. It's a great show. And he has this single coming. And, of course, every agent says that about every band that ever existed. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. But I liked the idea, the fact that he had just played at a club in New York City. And I did check it out, and there were rave reviews on it. And so I made a bid of $300. And he said, okay, he says, let me take that to the manager. And then maybe 5 days later, he says, Doug, the album's already getting played. I need more. So I think I went to $750. Then I went to $1,500. And by this time, the single was now moving up the charts. And Roger Abramson, good friend, he was the concert promoter at Music Hall downtown. I couldn't compete with 3,500 seats at Music Hall and lost him to Roger. And then just seemed weeks later, the exact same episode happened with Bette Midler. Again, I would offer $300 and go to $750, and then Roger got them. And then the next one like that was Yes. And months before they came to play at Reflections, their agent was saying, you know, they're going to have a new album. They'll have a single out. We really feel it's going to hit this time. And this wasn't their first album. They'd been around, but you still want to lowball them at the beginning. And so I offered $300 again. I seem to be stuck on that offering, that beginning offer. And so he accepted it, and we contracted it. And lo and behold, the single, Roundabout, just kept going up the charts. And by the time they got to Cincinnati, it was number 13 on the national charts. And we had sold more tickets, 2,001 tickets. It was the most successful concert we ever had at Reflections. We were actually only supposed to have 1,500 by the fire department, but we just got swamped, and we didn't know how many tickets we sold until until the place was packed, and we had to close the door. We could have sold more, but just no more could fit in. And what was great about that, and I'll always hold in great esteem the agency, the management, the band, they never once called back and asked to renegotiate the deal, where many acts, or I might say most acts, would have done so. And so I really compliment them for sticking to the original agreement. So that was probably, that was the biggest success we ever had. And then separately, because it's a Cincinnati story, Roger Abramson, again, the promoter at Music Hall, he called me and he said, RCA Records is interested in Pure Prairie League, which was a popular local band. And he said, I don't have a show at Music Hall where I can showcase them. And he said, could you please showcase them? The band would really love it. And I knew the guys, and I said, sure, we'll make a big deal of it. And we did, and we had a good crowd, and the guy flew in from New York, the RCA A&R man, and the band signed with RCA that week. And so I felt good that I was able to provide that for the band, and they were able to get the record deal. Because as Roger was saying, the band was playing at some little club would not have been as impressive to the RCA man. The last acts I booked, basically I did the booking, and I was the promoter. Ken Cornell was in charge of the sound and the lights and the stage production, and Daniel Wolfe, he ran all the operations and the bar, etc. And so the last shows that I booked were Yes and Genesis. There was a National College concert convention down at the Javits Center, and so there were artists that came in to play at that convention. And so we got Bonnie Raitt and Cheech and Chong and Martin Mull to come play at the club. And those were the last acts before I left sometime mid to late 1971 and moved to New York. Ken Cornell, he then, with one of our bartenders, Al Porkalab, a few years later, they went to create and build Bogart's, which I believe is still going in Cincinnati, which became highly successful. And so it was a fascinating experience. We often would buy acts along with the Agoras in the Agora Club in Cleveland and the Agora Club in Columbus, because if we could offer an act to have three successive nights, we'd get them for less money. We were lucky with Little Feat. Little Feat was new. They were on Warner Brothers. Warner supported them on their tours. And so we had, in 1 year, Little Feat come in three different times for very little money, because Warner Brothers would pay the expenses of their cost. And Boz Scaggs, a wonderful act. And he later became a big star years later with his hits. And fascinating acts. I mean, some memorable ones for me. I remember when we had Chuck Berry. Chuck Berry is an act who had started out in the 40s in Missouri, in racist areas where he probably didn't get paid half of the time. So he was very wary of going in, but he didn't have a road manager. He wouldn't tell you what flight he was on, where he was staying. He would just say, what time is the concert? And so he said, well, you're going on at 8 o'clock. And it's 8 o'clock and he's still not there. Then it's 8:05, he's not there. And then it's 8:10, and someone knocks on my door, and they said, Doug, Chuck Berry's here. So he comes in, and he's got his guitar in one hand and a briefcase in the other hand. And he doesn't say hello, and he puts his guitar down, and then puts his briefcase on the table, opens it up, and pulls out a .45 pistol with a long barrel. And he points it at me, and he said, okay, I would like the remaining 50% of my money. Because when we would book artists, you would send 50% up front to secure the date, and then you would pay the artists the remaining 50% before they go on stage. But because of his past experience, he just wanted to make sure that he got paid. And I kind of stepped back and I said, gee, Chuck, you don't need a gun to get paid. I'm happy to pay you. And I go in the safe and I take out the money. I give it to him. He puts the gun back in the briefcase. He said, okay, take me down to the stage. And because by 1970, 71, I forget which year it was, every rock musician in the world knew every Chuck Berry song. That's how they began rock and roll. And so he would just say, you just get five musicians on stage who know my music. And so he didn't know who they were, and he sees them for the first time when he walks on stage. There was a dressing room down by the stage. He took his guitar out. He walked up the steps. As he's walking by them, he said, the first song is Johnny B. Goode. And he plugged in and went right into it. He had a 60-minute concert listed on his contract. But every act always does one or two encores. But at 59 minutes, 59 seconds, Chuck did his last drum. He unplugged the guitar, walked off the stage. I'm down in the lower dressing room. He puts the guitar in the case, and he walked right out the door into the limousine that was waiting for him, and he left. So that was an interesting night. I mean, the audience didn't know half the problems that were going on. Another night, Velvet Underground was there, but halfway through the concert, the bass player just fell straight back on his back. Nobody knew whether he was dead or not. We were waiting for the band to stop, and we could rush, but the band didn't stop. They looked back at him. He was there. I guess they were used to it, and they finished the set, and then we found out and revived him, took him over to the free clinic across the street. So there were a lot of fascinating shows. The Allman Brothers Band, we had a new PA system that night. One entire section, the right side of the PA, blew up. And so the last half of the concert, they played on half of PA, but they went on and played for 3 hours, and truly, they were the best musical set of musicians I ever heard in a rock band. But it was an amazing experience, and we had a lot of great times. And sadly, the three gentlemen that I started the club with, Bob Ossenbeck, Ken Cornell, and Daniel Wolf, they're all gone now, and I'm the last man standing of the original group, and I have great memories of them, great memories of the club, and so many people that used to come there.
I'm Sandy Cohn, and I worked at Reflections from 1970 to 1971. I had a number of jobs at Reflections. I think I started off handing out flyers, delivering tickets to various music venues in the city. There was a stereo store that sold tickets and a bunch of other places. And I also was flinging beer at the time. It just so happened that I was 21, and I was one of the few people who worked there who was 21. And so I believe after they got a liquor license, I was recruited to be the bartender. Being the bartender at Reflections was interesting because, again, I was mostly pouring beer and making very simple drinks until the night that Boz Scaggs was performing. Boz Scaggs came up to the bar during the break and asked me for a tequila sunrise. Well, I had heard of a tequila sunrise, but I certainly didn't know how to make it. So I asked him how to make it, and he instructed me, and I did that. And then he said to me, well, this is a very good tequila sunrise. So I was quite proud of myself that I got to make a tequila sunrise for by Skaggs. Of course, I remember lots and lots of other groups there as well, but how I got there was interesting. I had a friend by the name of Peter Eden, and Peter knew that I was working my way through school. I was in special education at the time. He had heard of this new club, and he asked me if I thought I might like to work there, and he would put in the good word for me. And I went in one day and talked to Doug Yeager. It just so happened that I had met Doug previously, some years before, at a party at his house. But there were lots and lots of people there, and it was just a brief meeting, so I don't even think Doug remembered me. But I remembered him. And so he is the first person who gave me the job at Reflections. So a big thank you to Peter Eden for making that connection. What else I remember about Reflections was that it was a very, very active music venue. There were always really big groups there. I saw the Allman Brothers there and Chuck Berry. And during the Chuck Berry performance, I also remembered a woman dancing on the bar doing the splits. I'm not sure what the song Chuck Berry was playing, but everybody was really rocking and rolling in the place that night. Of course, I remember Yes. Yes was a phenomenal group to have at Reflections, a small venue. By the time they performed, Yes was really quite a big rock and roll group in the world, and we were very, very lucky to have them at Reflections. I think the Eagles were there. There was a group there called Sea Train, which has long been disbanded, but they were a great band. And, of course, a lot of local groups, including Stone Fox with Gene Utz, I believe, was pretty much the band leader of that group. So those are my basic memories of Reflections. It was a great place to work, and it's kind of sad that the place doesn't even exist anymore, but in our memories it does.
I never dreamed, before I started, that I'd chosen such a hard, hard road to choose. Farewell, sweet dreams, but now it seems that I will forever sing the blues.
Hi, I'm Peter Eden, and very proudly, I was in charge of all radio commercials for Reflections for their grand opening, as well as the many featured concerts that were held there in the early 1970s, and I did the production of the radio commercials for about a year and a half or 2 years' time. But Reflections truly was an ongoing, ever-changing type of experience in terms of the radio commercials. We wanted to aggressively promote the groups as they were coming into town, starting about 10 days out. Selling advance tickets was important to a room like Reflections. Obviously, if there were tickets still available, they were sold at the door at maybe a 50-cent premium. But we wanted to create awareness with our radio commercials for Reflections, primarily on WEBN, which was a young and upcoming radio station at the time. Frank Wood Jr. put EBN on the air around 1967 or 68, if memory serves me right. And EBN, by 1970, had a very successful following. Reflections, starting in 1970, was uniquely my only nightclub experience. I also did many, many radio commercials for the likes of Just Any Old Thing Clothing Store, which was headed up by Michael Hodash. I also did the commercials for radio for a clothing store called the New York Times on Calhoun Street, headed up by Neil Simon and Aaron Barr. Calhoun Street in its day, in the early 1970s to the, I would say even to 1980, let's say, or at least towards the end of the 1970s, was known for the very, very unique type of clothing stores, bead shops, head shops were very popular. Vine Street also was popular, but Calhoun Street had some wonderful stores, and that's where Just Any Old Thing clothing store and the New York Times clothing store were both located. They sold clothing of the day, of the period, and they all had beads and other types of wearable jewelry, costume jewelry, that their customers would love to wear. Reflections backstage during concert time was a crazy scene, as you can imagine. The acts literally stayed in their dressing areas. I don't believe we had rooms, per se, where the acts were prior to the concerts. But when they went on stage, they literally rushed out on stage. If it was a two-set performance, they would rush off stage, go right back to their private quarters. We always had their requested provisions, food, refreshments. That was part of the contractual agreement with the various groups. In Reflections, Daniel Wolf and Doug Yeager were geniuses in putting this room together from a design standpoint. The room had a reasonably large vacant area up front where people could either dance or congregate and watch the live concerts. But there also were, towards the back of the room, seating areas where people could lounge around and kind of relax if they weren't specifically interested in the dance music that was being played, or even during a live concert, they could mill around towards the back of the room. And yes, Reflections had primarily beer, which was popular with the young set during its early days, starting in 1970. That's what was popular, was the brewskis. And Doug Yeager and Dan Wolf hired a very, very creative print designer by the name of Ken Cornell. And we called Ken Cornell, his nickname was Corny. Ken did masterful placards that would be staple gunned to the various, they weren't street signs per se, they were lighting signs, let's say, all around the UC campus. One thing about Reflections that we really must appreciate, that Reflections at the corner of Vine and Calhoun Streets in Clifton, it was in the back door, front porch, however you wish to feel about it, of the UC campus. It was part of the UC campus. So our draw was primarily from the UC campus. Now, if Xavier students and other students wished to come to Reflections and enjoy the festivities, they were certainly welcome to. But Ken Cornell in particular, way ahead of his time from a design standpoint, put together these, let's say, 1.5 by 1 foot placards on cardboard, and we would have printed hundreds of them, and then they would be staple gunned all around the UC campus, again, like the radio commercials, to create awareness of an up-and-coming show.
Don't tell me none of them, don't lie as a woman, 'cause all you know I told you. Oh, don't sell me no alibi, sister, 'cause all you got I sold.
My name is Bill Maloney. I worked at Reflections from the fall of 1970 through fall of 1975. During that period of time, I started out washing dishes, becoming a manager, and eventually becoming the general manager of the entire club. During that period of time, we introduced a lot of rock and roll groups to Cincinnati. We were able to fortunately book them in conjunction with the Agores, which are two clubs, one in Cleveland and one in Columbus. Hank Lacani owned them. We were able to pick up dates for the groups that were emerging on their way, trailing from the East Coast to the West Coast to East Coast. And we'd pick up the midweek dates fairly inexpensively because we were picking up traveling costs. And so the record labels liked it because it reduced their promotion cost, but also gave us high visibility to some great acts. My responsibility is mostly operationally and keeping the place open, keeping it staffed, They had to open the doors and lock the doors at night, making sure the money got in the bank. One of the nights when I was closing the club, did a final walkthrough, and it was after the Yes concert, Cerrone had left Rick Wakeman's Mellotron in the dressing room. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm driving downtown to the hotel, dropping off the Mellotron to Rick Wakeman. So that was kind of fun. The other thing was kind of an interesting thing is that we decided we will support the free clinic night, and that was big night on Monday nights. And it grew to be where we get 1,000 or more people on a Monday night, which was unheard of in the club scene because no one could draw people on Monday night. It was a dead night of the week. And you see, the student body got free health care through the university health system as part of your student fees. Well, for whatever reason, the infirmary, they called it, they were getting muscle relaxers, prescriptions. And so there was an unbelievable amount of muscle relaxers on campus. Well, when it was Monday night, 25-cent night to get reflections, 35-cent beer nights, guess where everybody was downed out. It got so bad in a while, we had to turn the night off because there was too many people that were out of control. One of the other fun stories was when we had Cheech and Chong in concert, we had two shows, and this was while I was a student at UC. And I opened up the first show, got it going, I turned it over to one of the managers, and I went home to study because I had a final the next day. So I came back after the show was over and was double-checking the money in the gate and found out that the manager had not read the contract correctly, and instead of paying them half of the door, he gave them 100% of the door in cash. And so the tradition at the time was, because it wasn't any electronic tickets, you would print a roll of tickets, they would certify how many tickets you had printed and how many you sold, and then that would show you how much they would get. So at 3 o'clock in the morning, myself and Ken Cornell went down to the Holiday Inn where they were staying and were knocking on doors. I went down to the front desk, and I had their room numbers. So we went up to the first room number, and the knock on was Tommy Chong's. And he said, you know, Cheech is the guy in charge of money. You guys can talk cheap. So we got into the other room and knocked on the door, and Cheech Marin was there. Opened the door, and he's, you know, in his underwear. Because, oh, come on, it was a typical Holiday Inn. You had the desk on the right and the bed to the left. And we laid out paperwork, and Cheech was feeling good. And he was a true gentleman. He said, that's fine, I understand. Here's half your money back. And I didn't realize in the meantime there was a girl in bed. And Ken had crawled in with this young lady. So I grabbed Ken quickly, and we left. And Cheech didn't get mad. And I still carried the money, and it worked out real well. The other final thing that we were trying to figure out how to market ourselves better. What we did was we contacted the University of Cincinnati Marketing Department, and we decided to do a survey of where their interests were, where their background was, the feeling for their age, their music types, and how much important dancing was. And we had some great results. We found out that their average age. Now, understand, this was before there was photo IDs, and the drinking age was 18. We found out the average age of our clientele was 16 and a half. And so we were in shock. We didn't want to lose our liquor license. And so quickly we became the street name of rejections because we started looking closer at all the IDs. And there'd be nights we'd put 1,500 to 2,400 people through the club. So it was a busy, busy, busy club.
No stems, no seeds that you don't need. Acapulco Gold is
bad as weed.
Cut. How'd that sound to you?
Hey, man, that was far out, man. We got a cut, man.
Yeah, that sounded pretty good to me. I think we can wrap it up.
Oh, I know, man. No, I want to do it again, man.
Again?
Yeah, man, like I had a thing to do, you know, where you talk, man, where the cat talks. I got a thing to say, man. I was going to say it, but I forgot it, man.
You want to do it again?
Yeah, man, let's do it again, man.
Okay.
Hold it. Give me a joint, man. Give me another joint.
Ready?
Yeah.
Acapulco Gold filters, take 403.
Now, this is some bad weed.
Hi there, folks. Smoking more now, but getting high less? Try new Acapulco Gold filters, regular and menthol. Acapulco Gold, just a stony, 3 hits longer. And be sure to save the groovy coupons on the back. How do you think I got this? Out of sight hash pipe.
I'm Stan Hertzman. I'm 76 years old. I'm retired from music and other things. Mostly music, because that's what I did for a career. Back in the days of Reflections and live music and bands that traveled creatively, I was a booking agent. We had an agency called AJ Entertainment. It was, I believe, the largest regional booking agency in America that handled these type of bands. If we weren't, somebody's going to tell me who was, because we had, at one point, 11 people working in the booking office just booking bands. And that was before disco. Everything was before disco. Disco was the spine of demarcation of live music, as far as anyone who booked back then understands. We were not promoters. We were booking agents. So we did help coordinate music for the Cincinnati Pop Festivals, the ones at the Garden and the one at Crosley Field, with the promoters who were from Detroit. We eventually became the house bookers for Reflections in Cincinnati, and that was mostly in the early 70s. Doug Gabriel and Ken Cornell and Al Porkalov were part of the early regime that handled Reflections off the ground. But once they kind of split out and Reflections was left to the owner, a guy named John Dietz, and Dale Maloney, who was a really good manager, and they had lots of good managers, they pretty much turned the booking over to us, although they occasionally had some groups they put in there. It didn't matter. We never held it. We put in 50 weeks of entertainment, or 52, whatever they were open, on rotation of bands that they either got to see by them playing at the place, or that we knew from the road that he had great reputations and weren't a high risk. Some of the bands that went through Reflections and the players that were in them was one of Tommy Shaw's band, MS Funk, out of Chicago. Tommy Shaw joined Styx later, and then he had a record or two on his own. He was really great. They came down and played for us for an audition night on a Monday, and of course they got steady work out of whenever they wanted to play at Reflections. Meantime, Cal Levy handled the Agoras in Cleveland and the Tomorrow Club in Youngstown, and there's clubs all over in those days, and they were big clubs. So anyway, great days back then. We brought a band in from Rochester called Black Sheep. Black Sheep's lead singer was the guy from Foreigner, Lou Graham. Loudest band I've ever heard. The guy who wrote I Had the Time of My Life, what is the name of that song? A song from Dirty Dancing. Frankie, and I can't think of his last name right now, and I should, but I'm not. His band was called originally the Chocolate Watch Band, but then they changed their name to Bull Angus. Bull Angus came down from Rochester, New York, or some New York town. The band's coming in from all over. A great band called Chopper out of Michigan. Exile, of course, was close by, but they were, you know, standard there. Brother Bate from Atlanta, music groups with people who are closer to my age, maybe 10 years younger or around that age, will recognize. They would play on record for rotation. Then, of course, there were the local bands that were really strong, always played there for a week. In the days of Big Orange, which was an offshoot of the East Orange Express, which was big, which was an offshoot of Ivan and the Sabres, or Starstruck, who eventually had a hit record under a different name called Black Betty. Not the name of the band, but the band was then called Ram Jam, but it was the same record edited down. They played there. Borrow Time, a band I mentioned earlier, played there. Whale Feathers played there. Anybody was any good. I mean, it did a lot of good music in this town, all over the place, and regularly would play at Reflections. We used to do Monday night auditions at Reflections. If we had some bands that were coming through and he had a Monday night off and weren't going home, we'd book them on a Monday night, and they got a small amount of money, and they come in and play one set. We'd book three bands to play one set each, and we'd see them, and we'd audition for not only just our agency, just for the club. If we didn't want to sign them, but the club liked them, very rare that happened, because the club was a picky club, and we were picky about the club. Then that's where we saw them. One of the last bands that we, before the place went disco, that we saw at Reflections, was a band at Toledo called The Raisin Band. Six-piece band, if I believe I'm counting the members, right? Drummer, keyboard player, bass player, two guitar players, and lead singer. The two guitar players, I can't remember. Maybe it's five-piece, and I'm throwing an extra guy in there. But anyway, the Raisin Band was Rob Fetters and Bob Nicewanger's original band. And we came, and we booked them a lot. What was starting to deteriorate that circuit, they went down the road a little bit. They were a tough band to road because they weren't conventionally commercial, but they were high entertainment thing and really high musicality. Anyway, long story short, so every Monday night, really, for about 4 years in a row, you would find our whole office at Reflections on a Monday night, eating a little pizza, enjoying ourselves, and watching three bands from 9 to 1 in the morning. And we did that every Monday night. It was a regimen, really. And that was the role that Reflections really played in our office. It was a big deal. Management was great. Here's a side story, and I hope I'm not embarrassing anybody by this, but the owner of the club, we got to lunch with him to talk about booking. His name is John Dietz. He's a real swell guy. I'm not even sure if John is alive. I hope he is. Anyway, we're at Mecklenburg's in Clifton, and we're eating outside, and it's Stan Silverman and me and John, and we're talking about the schedule. He said, everything's really great. But everything was going great. This was pre-disco, pre-Burgundy's, as they changed their name to. And he said, just so every band that you book in their place, this song called Smoke on the Wall. at that time, our ears about him first because it was really supposed to be Smoke on the Water. You know, and he said, that's why I want to make sure that that was such a high demand song. And the band, frankly, hated playing it because any creative cover band doesn't like to do the biggest spots. Like Brown Eyed Girl got to be such a, not in that circuit, but in modern, more modern days for weddings that everybody had to play Brown Eyed Girl. They wanted to kill themselves. They had to play it one more time. So it was a neat thing. But John Deese wasn't the music guy per se, but he was a good businessman and he trusted us. And I thought that was really great. We had good relationships with the club and still do with the people. I still see Doug Yeager every time he's in town, hopefully. And we keep in contact and so forth and so on. But it was back in the day, as they say. It was a different scene. It was Camelot in the music business, even on a regional level. Today, there's no such thing as a circuit. It just doesn't exist. Anyway, and they got money. They got decent money. When I say that, the money they got today was much better than bands get paid per round today, so to speak. But it still wasn't big money, but it was enough that they could sustain their careers and have a shot at doing something larger. And quite a few of them did, either collectively or individually. It was a neat time.
Ready?
Than I could feel, touching what is real. All my mind is reeling round, 'cause Caroline is feeling down today.
You've been listening to the memories of many who worked at and attended shows at Reflections, a legendary Cincinnati concert venue, celebrating its 50th anniversary next month, November 10th. And here's a special shout-out to Doug Yeager for all his help with the photos and background information you'll find on my blues page on WVXU's website.
And I just want to say to Lee Hay, who I've done maybe three or four shows with in the past, she's just been wonderful at the station and a good friend, and I know she's retiring, and I want to wish her the best of luck in your next journey.
I'm Lee Hay, and you're listening to 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati and 88.5 WMUB Oxford.